Right, here we go. Didactic Mind, episode 10. Hard to believe this has been going for 10 weeks, but it actually has. The subject of this year, this very first podcast of 2020, is simply to wish everybody a very, very happy new year. And over the course of the next hour or so, I want to devote about half of the time to talking about what 2019 was like for me, and relating to perhaps some of the struggles and trials and tribulations that all of you faced, and some of the lessons that I learned from it. And the second half, I want to look ahead to 2020 and make some simple predictions about what we can expect for the next year, more or less. My skills as a prognosticator are pathetic, but even so, we will see what happens, because this coming year looks to be, at least from what I'm seeing right now, a pretty impressive one on a number of fronts. So, as I said at the outset, very happy new year to everybody listening in on this. For my long-time readers, a very, very warm welcome. God bless you all. I just wish all possible peace and happiness upon you and your families. To everybody listening into this on SoundCloud, if you have not subscribed already, please hit the subscribe button so you never miss a new podcast upload. And always head over to the blog and check out what's being written up there. Pretty much daily posting. It's very rare that I miss a day to post, and if I do miss a day, I'll usually make up for it the next day with a couple of additional posts to catch up. There's always something going on. It's a really cool place nowadays, with a lot more people who have stopped by and started commenting. It's quite a bit more active. There's some just really good and decent people who read my work and who try to kind of engage with me on a number of subjects. So, well worth your time. And for those of you who are listening in for the very first time, welcome. Welcome to the first episode of 2020. And welcome to your experience of listening to me, Didact, going on for, however long, on whatever subject I choose. In this episode, as I said, let's talk about what I went through this year, or not this year, in 2019, the past year, and what lessons I learned from it. So, I think 2019 for me was a very challenging year on a number of levels. It's been a very difficult year because of all of the personal losses that I faced, and it was cumulative losses from 2018 onwards. I mean, for those of you who have kept up, 2018 was just awful. It was the worst year of my life. Everything I had just exploded. And I lost almost everything. I lost my job. I lost my place in the USA. I had to leave. I had to come back to the dirt world. I had to endure a lot of turbulence in my personal life. My professional life was a complete wreck. It was just a really, really difficult year, and it got more and more difficult towards the end of the year. I mean, it started out horrible in March, and it kind of just got progressively more horrible over time with, there were brief upswings from time to time. But overall, it was just a horrible year. And I went into 2019 thinking, it can't possibly be this bad again. Well, I was wrong. It was actually worse in some ways. Not in all, but in many ways it was worse. So at the end of 2018, I started a new job, and I was working for a startup company, basically, in Southeast Asia. And I was working as kind of an offshore remote engineer. So I was working for them a couple of time zones away and had to basically log in, and work remotely 2.5 hours behind their time zone, which wasn't convenient. It wasn't easy, and it certainly didn't make for the best working relationship, but we did manage to get some stuff done. It wasn't ideal. It wasn't particularly fun sometimes, but it did have the benefit or the freedom of not having to have somebody looking over my shoulder all the time. And so I could kind of skip out during the day and go to the gym and work out and then come back and arrange my schedule a bit around that, because of all of the stuff that's going on here in terms of scheduling. It's not easy to just nick off and do whatever I want whenever I want to. It's one of the frustrations of living, you know, not in your own home, but in someone else's home and following someone else's rules. And it's just, you know, that is the reality of life. When you're in that situation, you just have to make the best of it. And for the past year and a half almost, I've really struggled with making the best of it, because it's been hard to see how to make the best of something when you're kind of stuck without any real recourse to something else. But at least I had started this job, and it was looking pretty good. I mean, the people in the company said, okay, you know, we applied for your work permit to come to Singapore. It didn't work out. Give us 6 months, and we'll try to reapply. And I said to them, okay, you've got 6 months. So I worked for them, you know, for 6 months' time. And at the end of that time period, I went back to them and said, hey, guys, what's going on? And they said, okay, we're going to try to put you on this new project that we've got. And you need to investigate how to use this cloud computing platform for a client of ours, cloud services. And it was Microsoft's Azure platform. So for those of you who haven't had the joy of working with Microsoft products, let me tell you this right away. Don't use them. Microsoft's user interface is horrible, and it is basically an Indian-run company at this point. I mean, its CEO is Indian. Much of its top brass, not at the C level, not yet, but at the kind of next echelon down, and the next couple of echelons below that, is heavily Indian. And what that means is that you get the very corrupt and corrupting Indian mindset coming into that environment. And the result is you have a platform that really isn't any fun to use. It's slow, it's clunky, it looks a bit stupid. It's really not a particularly user-friendly platform. And if you're trying to do even basic tasks, such as loading and extracting and transforming data, it's really slow. I mean, I was shocked at how slow this platform was at simply transforming, you know, 8,000 records. I mean, if you know anything about SQL, and you know how to use SQL, which I do, you'll know that 8,000 records is trivial. That's like, it's you don't even notice in SQL that you're manipulating that few records. It only gets to be a problem when you're dealing with tens or, you know, hundreds or of thousands or even millions of records. If you're dealing with 80,000 records, that's a whole different story. But 8,000 records, I mean, you can look that up and manipulate it and change it very quickly. It may have even been less than that. So it's a tiny data set, relatively speaking. So, you know, I was working on this project and it fell through because the client with whom I had no interaction realized very quickly that this platform was horrible. And they said, yeah, we're not interested. So, you know, there went that opportunity. And I have to say it was the most unpleasant professional experience I've ever had. I mean, I've worked for companies with 100,000 people in them, and I've encountered less bureaucracy and faster response times and more agile turnaround, because they have the systems to do this stuff, for basic questions about payroll and HR related matters and stuff like that in companies that should be massively bureaucratic than I have with a company with less than 50 people in it. So it's shocking to me that that this happened. But you know, all that you can do in a situation like that is learn to roll with the punches. And in my case, you know, due to a lot of complicated personal circumstances, it wasn't easy to do that. I'm not making excuses. I'm just saying that's the way it was. Pretty much every single job application I filled out was rejected because of visa issues. I mean, it's becoming much harder everywhere around the world to get a work visa if you're not from that country. It's really getting very difficult. This is one of the consequences of the move away from globalization, which I'm going to talk about later on, I think. So there was that, and you know, that kept me kind of stewing in my own juices pretty much until about October. But even then, the saga still wasn't over. It still isn't over. They still owe me money, and I still have their hardware with me. So it's like, what do you do in a situation like this? Well, you know, you just try to sort it out the best you can. I think the major lesson that I learned from that was reinforced the lesson that I learned in 2018, which was that you cannot trust the system. The system that's out there right now is one that says, study hard, work hard, enter a giant faceless corporation, become a nameless cog in the machine, sell your soul to your employer, and in exchange for your soul, we might take care of you. Maybe. As long as it's convenient for us, we'll take care of you. But the moment you cause trouble, oh, no. We have no obligation to you. You're gone. Bye-bye. You're fired. It doesn't matter that this will destroy your life. It doesn't matter that your career goes up in smoke. It doesn't matter that everything you've worked for 10 years suddenly becomes irrelevant. It doesn't matter that you lose everything. No, that's not relevant to us. We don't care. What matters is our profits and our quarterly shareholder reports. That's what matters. The companies that embrace this mindset are universally beginning to struggle very badly, actually. There are some exceptions, such as Amazon, but even they are facing their own problems. And they're beginning to realize that this is not a good way to treat people, but that kind of corporate inertia takes a long time to overcome. And the problem is that mindset is as true of a giant corporation like Amazon or, you know, let's say one of the big banks, whether we're talking Bank of America or Deutsche Bank or Barclays or any of the big banks. They all have the same problem. They all have the same approach to things. And it's the same mindset that applies for small startups where, you know, you take a big risk joining up one of them, but you sign up for relatively low pay, but you sign up for the promise that eventually bigger and better things will come. And sometimes that doesn't, well, quite a lot of the time actually, that doesn't work out because the startup in question may be managed absolutely abysmally, which is generally true for startups overall. So the lesson to learn there is, seriously, don't trust the system anymore. It's not going to do you any good. You've been ripped off and lied to your whole life. And the lesson that I learned in 2019 is that unless you have a really good reason to believe someone when he tells you, yes, I'm going to take good care of you, I'm going to make sure that you're going to be okay, the reality is nobody's going to look out for you. No one. No one's going to take care of you. And it's profoundly depressing when you realize this. It's profoundly hurtful when you realize this because it goes against everything a lot of us have been taught all of our lives. I mean, if you come from an Asian background or an urban, you know, sort of suburban Western background, you've been taught all your life that if you just study hard and you just work hard and you just keep your nose clean, everything's going to be fine. You're going to be okay. nothing's going to go wrong. You'll face some ups and downs, but overall, your trajectory will be up towards a reasonable upper middle class standard of living. Okay, that's nice, but it's not true anymore. It's not. The only person who's going to give you that living is you, and if you don't go out and get it for yourself, you're not going to have it. On top of this, these professional setbacks. I mean, every single job application I sent out was rejected, and I was sent out at this point a couple of hundred, around the world. Every single one was rejected. Again, because of the visa issue. It wasn't because of my lack of qualifications. It wasn't because of my experience. It was because of the visa issue. On top of all of that, there were a couple of really bad family losses. I mean, in December, I lost one of my uncles. He'd been battling cancer for a long time, and he died. He died after a 4-year fight with cancer. The cancer had returned. It had spread to his other internal organs. It had spread, essentially metastasized to his brain. In the end, he just said, you know what? I'm not going to go through another round of chemotherapy because it's not going to work. Success rate is very low. I am definitely not going to go through surgery again. I don't want to put myself through that kind of pain. I just want to die on my own terms, is effectively what he said. And all you can do in a situation like that is respect him. You know, when somebody says something like that, all you can do is say, respect. You know, just say, he went out like a man, on his own terms. Death is terrifying for each of us to confront, but I keep coming back to that line in the movie Gladiator, in which Russell Crowe's character Maximus quotes Marcus Aurelius, "Death smiles at us all. All a man can do is smile back." And there's another line from Proximo earlier on in the film where he says, "In the end, we're all dead men. Sadly, we cannot choose how we meet that end, but we can sadly, we cannot choose when or how, but we can choose how we meet that end, so that we may be remembered very simply as men." And that's how I choose to remember him. He went out on his own terms. So I came back from a couple of weeks of travel. You know, he died while I was away. I came back, and a few days later, I was on my way to a funeral. And then right before New Year's, like right around Christmas time, actually, we got news of another uncle, my father's brother, actually, who was hospitalized with a massive heart attack. And we don't know what the prognosis is. I'm not going to speculate. But this is somebody who has not lived a good life. I'll just put it that way. I'm not going to go into details because they're very painful and very private for us. But it really rams home how terrible the consequences of using and abusing people all your life will be, and how terrible the consequences are of not taking care of yourself and of your body. So that was another major lesson, not one that I needed to learn, but one that I think everybody in general needs to learn, because I do take good care of myself. I mean, I try to. It's not easy around here, believe me. I do try to stay in good shape. Again, not easy. I do try to stay active. I do try to watch what I eat. I don't drink much. I don't smoke at all, ever. I don't take drugs. And I generally try to treat people well, insofar as I am able. But even all of that is not enough in a place and a culture without access to the healing word and Holy Spirit. If you don't have that, if you reject it openly, I'm not saying you can't still live a good life, because you can. There are plenty of atheists, plenty of virtuous pagans, plenty of good and decent non-believers, or agnostics, if you will, around the world who live a much better, cleaner, more spiritual life than I do. Good for them. I mean, in all sincerity, good for them. They are better people than I am, and I respect them for that. But one thing you're going to realize very quickly is that when you have the Holy Spirit looking out for you and looking after you and influencing you, guiding you, sanctifying you, you become protected from some of these evil things that affect other people, such as alcoholism and womanizing and addictions to pornography and, you know, addictions to drugs, and the desire to take advantage of people, the desire to be dishonest or to cheat people. You are still susceptible to them because we're all flawed and broken creatures, but you have a defense against these things, which is really powerful. You really have something out there looking out for you, trying to guide you back onto the straight and narrow and telling you, hey, it's gonna be okay. It's gonna be all right. Keep the faith. Stay calm. So that's another major lesson that I learned, because I bowed the knee and became a Christian in sort of mid-January of 2019. And it took a long time for some of these cumulative effects of the Spirit to help me out. And I still make a lot of mistakes, but I see now just how powerful that influence can be. And that's why in my New Year's message today, I exhorted my brethren to take the plunge. And if you're still questioning about it, you know, just go ahead and say, I accept Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior, as my King, and I want to be one of His flock. You tell the Lord, I want to be one of yours. I want to be one of your children. And amazing things start happening the moment you bow the knee and, you know, bend your head and say to the Lord and to Jesus, forgive me for my sins, forgive me what I've done. I accept you into my heart, into my life. I want to be part of what you represent. I want to be part of the truth. That lesson has been a profound one for me. And it's what has kept me optimistic in the face of everything that's tried to knock me down. And you can see that in my writing. You can see that I am profoundly happy in a lot of ways when really I shouldn't be. Because I can see around us that even though my life might be in the shit, I can see around me that what is good, what is beautiful, and what is true is gaining ground, is winning victories. And again, I'll come back to that shortly. The final major lesson that I learned from 2019 concerned the nature of relationships between men and women. Now, here I'm simply going to say that if you find yourself with a woman who it has emotions and drama, which is to say pretty much all of them, you're going to find yourself from time to time wondering what the hell you've gotten yourself into. Because she's going to go batshit insane over something that you think is not a big deal. You're going to be like, what the hell? I mean, all I did was sit down and take a bite of food and you wanted me to go over there and take your picture. Can't Instagram wait for 2 minutes while I take a mouthful to eat? And from your point of view, you're going to be behaving very rationally. What you're going to fail to realize is that to her, you're rejecting her. You're rejecting her attempts to get close to you. And you're rejecting her desire to be around you. And this is a weird lesson to learn. And it takes a lot of time and effort to figure out where you're making this mistake. You'll also end up making a pretty typical mistake, which is that you will try to respond rationally to something that is purely emotional, which is a huge mistake, and every man makes it. Every single man, no matter how accomplished he is with women, makes this mistake all the time. Because we men are much more rational creatures than women, and that's just a fact. We will look at something very matter-of-factly and say, you know, I think X. And you'll get a completely irrational response to that statement. It's not that what you said was wrong. It's just that she doesn't look at it the same way. And trying to balance out your masculine nature with her feminine nature is a major challenge. There's no guidebook for doing it. I mean, there is one called The Way of the Superior Man, which is very good. David Data is a very interesting writer. He's got, you know, I thought his writing style was very florid and silly when I first encountered it. But then I actually read all the way through the book, and I was like, wow, this is quite well written. And it is. It is very well written. But most men never find a woman who is emotional and crazy and difficult and tempestuous, and also can explain why she's like that, and also can take the time to explain to you why she's reacting the way she is, why she's blowing up more often, what it is that she's missing. Very, 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 very few women in the world have the emotional maturity, the experience, and the self-awareness to say to their men, I want to be feminine around you. I want to be loving and caring. I want to express my emotions with you. I want to be kind to you. I want to be sweet with you. But I can't be, because you take all of my feminine energy and you don't give me any masculine energy back. This is critical. You have to understand that in a really good balanced relationship, the feminine energy of the woman must be balanced by the masculine energy of the man. And if that sounds a bit too Eastern mysticism, hippy-dippy, yoga-type meditation philosophy for you, I understand why. But it's true. The masculine energy is that of the protector, the provider, the nurturer, well, not the nurturer, the strong physical presence and the support, the rock, the anchor upon which everything else is built. If you don't provide that, and if you don't show your woman how much you appreciate her from time to time, you're going to be confronted with a woman whose feminine energy is spent. She has nothing more to give you. And that is when the trouble really starts, because that's when the drama from hell happens. That's when sex goes off the table. That's when you have no recourse to any way of calming her down, because you just respond to her very coldly and logically. You don't respond to her with empathy, love, affection, care, compassion. You don't call her sweet names. You don't show her how much she means to you. And if you don't do these things, you're going to be in trouble. Because that feminine energy is not infinite, just as our masculine energy is not infinite. You need to find ways to replenish both. And that's on you as a man. And if you fail in that regard, which you will, from time to time you will fail, then you will be swiftly punished for it by way of tremendous drama, tremendous rouse and anger and anxiety. And you're going to be like, why the hell am I in this relationship? I mean, you're basically going to say to yourself, right, that's it, peace out, you know, I'm done. And most of the time, you're probably justified in doing that. But you need to remember that when this happens, you need to acknowledge your own mistakes, because relationships don't break down just because of one party, usually. They always break down because of things that both parties have done. Both sides involved have made mistakes. Both sides involved have severe errors of judgment. And when that happens, if you're not listening to each other and you're not trying actively to fix your behaviors, then you're in very, very bad territory. The surest sign I can tell you from what I learned in 2019 is if you're with someone who simply refuses to change his or her ways, depending on if you're a woman or a man, if you're with someone who simply will not modify behavior based on honest, earnest, caring feedback, constructive criticism, that is the very definition of a toxic relationship, and you need to get out as fast as possible. Get out, don't look back. Don't try to come back, just say, that's it, I'm done. This person is truly horrible and unpleasant to be around and is never going to change, so I'm not taking it. Get out because life is too short. If, however, you're in a relationship where, after you explain your point of view, everything's calmed down, and you tell whoever it is that you're with, I didn't like the way you did this, or I think this was very badly behaved by you, you really hurt me in this way, and he or she says, okay, that's reasonable, I won't do it again. You know, it takes ownership for, if you're a man, if you take ownership for what you've done, and you say, I see that I hurt you. Okay, won't happen again. That's really all it takes. That's all you need to do. Just admit that you were wrong. You don't have to apologize for it, not necessarily, unless you're genuinely sorry, in which case, apologize. But if you're just saying sorry for the sake of saying sorry, don't bother. It's useless. You know, you're making yourself seem weak as well as indecisive, which are two things women cannot stand. Simply admit that you were wrong, because that's not weakness. Admitting that you're wrong is not weakness. Admitting that you're wrong is a sign of strength. It really is. It's a sign of maturity, wisdom, and compassion. And the moment that you admit you're wrong, you can figure out what it is you did wrong, and then fix that. So, do it. Fix it. Don't sit around waiting for these problems to fix themselves, because they never will. So, those are the lessons that I've learned. You know, a couple of them were reinforced from previous years. Don't trust the system. It'll find ways to break you and kick you when you're down. Always do your level best to maintain your body and your health, in every way, physical as well as mental. Accept Christ as Lord and King. And if that's too much of a step for you, okay, I get it. Look, I understand. I was the same way for years, 4 or 5 years. I was exactly the same. I was in exactly the same position you are in. You know, 2015, my grandfather died, and that brought me closer to the Lord, but I still wasn't ready to take that next step. I couldn't bring myself to say, okay, Christ, you win. Jesus, you win. You know, I couldn't bring myself to say that. I get it. It's terrifying. Because you're operating away from the principles of rational understanding. You're operating now on principles of faith. And that's a terrifying place to be if you don't understand the experience of faith. It's hard. But take the risk. What have you got to lose? You've got nothing whatsoever to lose and everything to gain. See where it takes you. Because I can't promise you anything much, but I can promise you this. It will take you to places that you did not expect and that are truly wonderful. You know, you will see relationships rebuilt that you thought were destroyed. You will see opportunities open for you that you thought were not possible. You will experience support and love and brotherhood from people that you never even knew existed. There are so many people out there right now praying for Donald Trump, for instance, the God Emperor of mankind, that he will never meet. There are millions of Americans praying for him. He's never even met most of them. But he's protected nonetheless because of their prayers. He's doing things nonetheless because of their prayers. And finally, when it comes to women, know what you're up against. If you find yourself a really good woman who is willing to change her behaviors for you, insofar as anyone can change, because remember, if you're with a woman, what she's like now, you know, after, well, what she's like after 6 months of serious dating and serious time spent together is what she's going to be like for the rest of her life. She's not going to change very much. If you go into a relationship with a woman and you think, oh yeah, she's going to be exactly like she was for the first 2 months of our time together for the rest of her life. No, that's not going to happen. When you're with a woman for the first 2 months, it's wonderful. It's exciting. It's emotional. You're both full of endorphins and hormones. You can't get enough of each other. You can't wait to spend as much time together as possible. But that cools over time. And especially after the first 2 months, which is at some point during that time, she's going to turn around and absolutely rip your head off at some point. I mean, Adam Piggott, the Gentleman Adventurer, mentioned it in a podcast some time back, a couple of years back, I think, where he said, essentially, you're going to wake up next to a girl and say, hey, honey, how's it going? It's a wonderful day outside. What'd you like to do? And she just turns around and goes full Mama Grizzly on you, rips your head off and shits down the cavity. She's going to do that. Why? Because she can no longer maintain the emotional pretense of being that sweet, loving, sexy thing that she was when you met her. Now she feels at a very visceral emotional level that you don't accept her for who she is, and she can no longer maintain that pretense. You're no longer good enough for what she wants. So at that point, you got a choice to make. You know, do you cut bait and run, or do you persevere and try to change your disagreeable behaviors and try to get her to change her own disagreeable behaviors? If you decide to stick around, realize that neither of you is going to change very much. Not in the ways that really matter. Whatever values you bring into the relationship, that's what you're going to have for the rest of the relationship. So, with all of that out of the way, let's talk about a couple of topics that I had hinted at earlier. You know, these are the lessons that I've learned on a personal level. Now let's take a look at what's going on around the world and try to make a few predictions for what will happen in 2020. So 2019 was really the year in which we saw the left take probably the most vicious beating it's ever taken. And they didn't expect it. They didn't realize this. I mean, 2016 was impressive because we saw the election of the God Emperor, or I should say, his most illustrious, noble, august, divine, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name. All hail the God Emperor. But 2016 saw two, you know, critical events. It saw the Brexit vote, which, of course, completely turned the existing electoral calculus on its head, and it saw the election of the God Emperor. Both of these events were seismic shocks to the global system, but they weren't surprising. Not really, not if you've been paying attention. Because for the previous 25 years, what had been happening was the globalists had been winning. The argument had been best exemplified by, I think, Tony Blair and the new Labour Party of the 2000s, late 90s and 2000s. What happened there was essentially the Blair government came in and said, we are going to be socially liberal and fiscally conservative. We are going to embrace free market policies and trade agreements, and we're going to take the all of the good stuff that comes from capitalism, all of the economic benefits, and make sure that it's distributed out to, you know, the wider public. It's called the Third Way, and one of the key architects of the Third Way movement was a chap named Anthony Giddens. Tony Giddens was, I believe, the dean or chancellor. I think it was the dean of the London School of Economics at one point. Very influential guy, you know, quite a brilliant chap in terms of IQ and such, but totally misguided in terms of his conclusions. Now, the new Labour government in the UK, the neoconservative movement in the US with its idea of compassionate conservatism, and the neoliberal movement around the world, they all kind of said the same thing, that the time has come to open up our borders, to embrace trade, to embrace the free migrations and movements of peoples, and to ensure that the benefits of these things go down to the ordinary man on the street. Now, the first few things were embraced, the last bit was not. And all around the world, for 25 years, what we saw was a small sort of elite group, a relatively small segment of society, benefiting disproportionately from all of these things, getting rich, living in very exclusive enclaves, causing property prices to skyrocket, and really with very little benefit for the poor people, for the poor man on the street. There was very little benefit from any of this stuff. And for 25 years, people felt as though they didn't really have any choice, because every time they tried to tell their elected representatives, hey, we don't like this, this is not okay, this is not fine, they were told to shut up. They were told, you're just racist, you're reactionaries, you're xenophobes, you're troglodytes, you're just, you're not worthy human beings, you're opposed to progress in all of its wonderful forms. But then along came the God Emperor with his true third way. What was his third way? Well, he said, essentially, we want trade, but we want fair trade. We want the blue-collar man to benefit. We want the average factory worker to benefit. We want people to come into our country, but we only want the best. We want trade to be on our terms, not everybody else's terms. We want every aspect of society to benefit. We want everybody to have a job. We don't care, really, about gay marriage, but we don't care. We don't want our Christian moral values to be attacked either. And here's the key that all the third way types of the 2000s were missing. They didn't have a strong moral center. They embraced the god, the false god of capitalism, of the false god of mammon. And they said, we want almost unfettered capitalism, minimal government restraints. And in fact, they actually piled a lot of government restraints in other areas, you know, in terms of environmental regulation and market-killing, prosperity-killing, freedom-killing regulations about health and safety. But when it came to the core protections for actual people, no, those protections were stripped back and stripped down. So where does this leave us today? Well, it leaves us in a position, in a very unusual and yet unsurprising time in human history. Donald Trump is not new, and he's not unusual. He is crass, and he is verbose, but he's not surprising. We've seen men like him before. They are easily dismissed as demagogues, but they're not. They are simply a reaction by the people to the power of the elites. Trump is not the movement itself. The movement will continue on without Trump. And it's becoming very clear that the Republican Party is transforming quite rapidly, although Tucker Carlson said, you know, it's not nearly rapidly enough, and he's right. into a populist, blue-collar, nationalist party. That is a profound and fundamental change. It's a complete change away from the roots of the Republican Party, which was originally a big government, industrialist, protectionist party. It changed again under Ronald Reagan to become a more free market, open borders, libertarian type of outfit with a muscular foreign policy. It changed again under George W. Bush into this neo-clown outfit, which has led the entire world straight to the jaws of hell. But now, under Trump, it's changing yet again into probably what it always should have been, which was a party, was and is a party of the common man, which simply says that America is a wonderful nation. America is a great nation. America deserves to be governed for Americans in their interests, which means no more of these pointless, endless wars. No more of these, these trade deals where we just allow our markets to be opened with no response from anyone else. No more of these one-sided agreements where we give away our national treasure and protect everyone else at our own expense. No more. It's becoming the party of whites. And that's not a bad thing. It is becoming the party of white America. And the sooner that Republicans embrace this and realize it, the better off everybody's going to be. Because it is no bad thing for whites to elect representatives and act in their own racial interests. Blacks have been doing it for generations. Hispanics have been doing it for decades. Jews have been doing it for their entire existence. There's nothing wrong with voting for your own racial, national interests. It's just a fact that everybody does this. Whites should feel no shame about it. So in terms of what I see coming, I see in the UK Brexit happening, because at this point, I mean, Boris the Sheepadoodle has a tremendous election mandate to go ahead and deliver it. It won't be true Brexit. The UK is still going to be paying £39 billion to the vampire squid that is the EU. It is still going to be beholden to the common market for quite some time. It is still going to have to deal with a recalcitrant and adamant EU in terms of trade deals. It's not going to be full no-deal Brexit, which is actually the best possible situation. The best scenario was no-deal Brexit, because then the UK would have reverted to WTO trade rules and could have negotiated its way to have, you know, complete freedom and autonomy in trade. And it wouldn't have had to pay £39 billion. I do see that the NHS is going to fail ever more miserably, because socialized medicine always fails. It doesn't matter that Boris wants to inject £20 billion into the NHS. The thing is, you know, people say that Boris Johnson's a conservative. He's not a conservative. He's not a Tory. He's a populist. He's a big government conservative. He likes the idea of government getting involved in everything. But he has the right political instincts overall, because he understands that the NHS holds a very dear place in the British psyche. They consider it to be one of their greatest achievements. It's not, but that's what they think of it. He is going to go down the wrong road in a number of these areas, and he is going to be led down the wrong path by many of his own ministers and by his own instincts, because he has insisted on being the greenest, you know, prime minister ever. That's nonsense. I mean, the UK, nobody else in Europe needs this green nonsense. Nobody needs it. But he's going to do it anyway. Nonetheless, the UK is going to become the first of several nations that are going to look to exit the EU. Now that Britain's out, I believe Italy is going to be next. Eventually, once you know, their political deadlock is broken, which it will be eventually. I do think that's going to happen. I do think that Greece is going to want to exit the bloc sooner or later, because they will benefit massively from getting out. And once some of the southern Mediterranean countries leave, what's going to stop Hungary, Poland, Czech Republic from leaving? Not much, because Hungary and Poland have already formed their own very right-wing, very Christian nationalist axis, set in direct opposition to what Germany and France want, and what Sweden and Finland and the multi-culti, you know, suicide pact in the Nordic countries want. So, talking of the Nordic countries, what's going to happen there? Well, Sweden is going to elect a populist right-wing government, and then you're going to start seeing some really serious tensions flare up there. Sweden is rapidly becoming, you know, exhibit A in what happens when you let multiculturalism and liberalism, global, you know, neoliberalism infect a country. Finland isn't far behind. You know, they've got an all-female government, basically, of under 35 millennials. They're going to have a lot of fun dealing with somebody like Vladimir Putin in Russia, who actually knows how to deal with stupid people and simply doesn't let them get in the way. You're going to see major upheavals in the Scandinavian countries in 2020, starting, I believe, with Sweden, which is going to reach the breaking point sometime in this coming year. Looking at Russia, I've spent a fair amount of time in Russia. I love it there. I love the Russian people. I love the country. I think it's just a phenomenal place to be. I feel a lot more free in Russia in many ways than I do in the US, strangely enough. I think that Russia is going to continue to become a dominant military technological superpower. And I say this because if you look at the Russian military, it's not big. They don't have very many fighter planes. They don't have that many troops. They've got less than 1 million men under arms right now, with the ability to call up a reserve of, what, a few million more? It's not a big military. They have a relatively small handful of tanks, but even though they only spend about $50 billion a year on their defense industry, something like that, their bang for buck is vastly higher than anything that you get in the US. Their T-14 Armata is untested in battle. The Su-57 is untested in battle. Their aircraft carrier, they only have one, has caught fire. You know, it can't be repaired because the dry dock, the floating dock that was supposed to repair it, sank. I'm serious. I mean, this actually happened. But they don't need the aircraft carrier. The defensive posture of Russia, the posture of the Russian military is purely defensive, not offensive. But look to Russia to become kind of the gold standard alternative to buggy, expensive, over-engineered, brittle, largely useless American systems. The Russians actually know what they're doing. They know how to build stuff that lasts. And you're going to be seeing them exporting their Su-57 fighters, their T-14 tanks, and their military technology around the world. And more people are going to look to Russia as a central pole of a multipolar axis, you know, a multipolar world. Russia is a strategic competitor to the US, but it doesn't need to be an unfriendly one. And that's the part that I hope US policymakers will change. I hope they will come around to the view that Russia can be worked with. And I think once the God Emperor wins his re-election, which I believe will happen, you will see a softening toward Russia. Because at that point, I believe that Donald Trump will come back into the White House with an even bigger majority than he won last time. You know, he won 304 Electoral College seats, I think. I think he's going to win another 10, maybe 15 more this time. I'm serious. I think he's going to win an even bigger majority than he won in 2016. And I think he's going to utterly humiliate and destroy whichever Democrat he faces, whether it's Sleepy Joe Biden, Pocahontas, Saint Pete of I don't know, butt play or whatever it is, booty play or whatever the hell his name is. I mean, you know, America's not going to elect a gay quote unquote Christian from Indiana as president. It's not going to happen. Blacks will not vote for a gay man as president. And the moment that Democrats lose the black vote, they've lost the elections. They won't win another presidential election ever. I do believe that the current Democrat-controlled House will be swept away, because what has become very clear is that the Democrat Party has no ideas left. It has nothing left to give the American people. No policy achievements, no proposals, nothing. It has no idea how to use power. It only knows how to scream and shout and point fingers. And I do believe that when Trump wins in 2020, the storm will be unleashed, if not sooner. What I mean by the storm is this long-awaited draining of the swamp, which has been happening for the last 4 years. It's been going on. It's been an ongoing, slow, difficult, painful process. What most people don't realize, what a lot of Trump supporters don't realize, is that Trump has been very carefully, meticulously laying the groundwork. The judiciary in the United States is decidedly moving to the right. Decisively. Trump has appointed a huge number of federal judges to various posts who are originalists and conservatives, which means that once the justice system is under conservative right-wing control, nationalist control, the globalists don't have it anymore. One of their most useful tools for removing freedoms and power from the American people is gone. Now, what happens when he takes back the House of Representatives? Well, what happens when he increases his already decent majority in the Senate? Well, now you've got a president who is a nationalist, an America firster, who wants to deliver change for the American people, and who wants to drain the evil, festering swamp that is Washington, D.C. And now he has the power to do it. Now he no longer has Democrats threatening to impeach and obstruct his every move. Now he has the judiciary under firm control. Now he's going to have a chance to move the Supreme Court to a 6-3 conservative majority, because the notorious RBG is going to go bye-bye sometime fairly soon. Now he has everything in his favor. At that point, he is going to face a terrible temptation. He's going to be tempted to cast it all aside, to do the genteel and gentle thing, and basically say, oh no, I could crush my enemies, but I'm not going to. I'm going to be magnanimous. No. What he needs to do at that point is put aside that temptation to be seen as the peacemaker, the diplomat, the great healer, and win the Nobel Prize and all these other accolades, because you're not going to get them. We all know that. I think he knows that as well. I think he finally understands the level of hatred that the swamp has for him. And he needs to deliver the final blow. So, whether he will do that or not, we will see. But, as I said, Trump slide 2020, far more crushing. Russia and America moving toward warmer relations. The destruction of the EU, or at least the groundwork for it being laid. And I hope a bright and glorious future for Western civilization as we come out of this moral abyss, this dark age that we found ourselves in for a generation now, is all on the horizon. So have hope, brothers. Embrace Jesus Christ. Embrace the Lord. May the blessings of the most mighty God be upon you. Peace be upon you, my friends. And I hope you have all enjoyed a very happy and peaceful new year, and I will see you on the next one. This has been the Didactic Mind Podcast, episode 10. Happy New Year.